On this episode of The Midwife's Cauldron, we talk to Dr. Danielle Arabina about Aboriginal history and ancient medicine, medical magic, and how we can bring that into the world. We discuss how we no longer recognise the importance of our menstrual cycle, how we can benefit from sitting with ourselves properly during our cycle, about our womb space and the energy it carries, including pain, trauma, and loss that we may be holding on to. And Dr. Danielle talks to us about how she supports women to connect to their menstrual cycle and how she uses her work to assist babies land into this space. Dr. Danielle Arabina is a descendant of the Miriama people in the Torres Strait, a medical doctor, GP specialist, educator, and respected figure in the medical community. Through her formal higher education studies, trials, and cultural journeying, she has arrived into her true authentic self as a doctor, doula, healer, and Indigenous health educator. Dr. Danielle has a particular interest in holistic women's health, menstruation, childbirth, lactation, and postpartum care. We know you're going to enjoy this episode. God, there's some lovely golden nuggets in this one. So sit back, or pop the kettle on, or even start the car, and welcome to The Cauldron. I'm Katie James, and this is the Midwives Cauldron Podcast. Each episode, I'm joined by my incredible co-host, Dr. Rachel Reed. Listen in as we hubble, bubble, toil and trouble our way through aspects of womanhood, midwifery, birth and lactation. So go on, subscribe now, and hear us on your favourite podcast host. Good morning and good evening, and Dr. Danielle Arabina, I am so thrilled to have you with us in the cauldron and on the podcast. It is a real treat to have you here. So thank you so much for coming on and joining us today. And you have such a vast background, and it was so wonderful to bring you on in terms of yourself coming from the medical side and coming from a holistic healing mind, body and spirit side, and also working with GPs and being an Indigenous woman yourself. So it's a joy to have you on, but there are some specific areas that we really want to get in deep with you today. And I'm really looking forward to that.
Well, it's very good because getting in deep is my specialty. Wink, wink. So hello there, everybody.
Fabulous.
Yes. My name's Dr. Danielle Arabina. I'm a descendant of the Miriama clan groups in the Torres Strait. And I'd like to take the opportunity to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we are all standing, all of your listeners, and the elders past, present and emerging. So that's something that's really important for me to always start my presentations with, because it pays homage to the work I do on somebody else's land. So being a Torres Strait Islander woman, I acknowledge I work on Aboriginal country. And so thank you for letting me say that. And I always encourage anyone who works with me or does anything, listens to my work, is to really find out who your mob are, like who are your own ancestral lineage, but also whose land you're on, because it's so important for us to remember and reclaim our lineage.
Thank you so much. I think that's really important. And thank you. That's really lovely that it brought it to the podcast, whether people are in Australia or anywhere else in the world, because of those Indigenous people that are there and the land that we stand on is so important to remember.
And can I just say, I'm on Gubbi Gubbi or Cubby Cubby land, depending on whose language.
Yes, up at the old sunny coast. Where I am, it's quite a bit of a mystery, because it appears that I'm in a might be shared land, but there is evidence of Aboriginal history that is showing itself to me, which has only been happening in the last 2 weeks. So I feel really humbled and profound. I've got a lot of emotions around that, because it's quite an archaeological significance. It's a thing of great significance. Wow. So I think there's some magic that's activating up here that this stuff wants to be revealed. So I'm going through the correct protocols and talking with elders and trying to get this stuff recorded in the appropriate manner. So that's something exciting.
Absolutely. And to be able to discover, I think there's so much we know and there's so much we still don't know.
It's like our vaginas. Our vaginas and our womb. So much we don't know.
The more we investigate, the more people are taking women's bodies and women's health more seriously and including us in a category that deserves to be studied. The more we find out and the more questions we have, of course, as well. And the more empowered we can feel as women.
And that's something I find that's really important. I try to do a lot of education. I'm also a birth worker and a doula, so I work in that space of women's business, what we call women's business in sort of Indigenous culture, and really helping people remember their bodies and how amazing and magnificent they are. So just a little bit about me and how, you know, a good-looking chick like me came to be sitting on this beautiful podcast.
Too right.
And it's been a bit of a long and winding journey. I'm not going to give you the full story, but it really does connect a lot to my culture. So when I was a young girl, you know, this is an unusual story for a doctor to be presenting with, but when I was a young girl, I used to see spirit and they used to come and stand at the end of my bed and I would get scared and I'd run and jump into the bed with my big sister. But it was almost the ghosts or whatever they were would come and stand at the end of my bed. And I'd try and talk to my father who worked away a lot. I'm Torres Strait Islander through my father's lineage and I'm also Celtic and Viking. So I love that sort of mixture of wildness and, you know, strength, which is really what I try to embody a lot of, which is interesting in the work I'm doing in the world now. I'm leading a revolution, just nothing. You know, it's just a little thing and I'm going to encourage everyone to come on board. But so when I was a young lass, seeing ghost and spirit and realizing I still had this really deep connection to nature. And so I was a bit of a nerd, as you know, that's probably not a surprise for anybody who knew me. I used to make a little marine biologist book and I'd go down to the foreshore at Wynnum where I grew up and, you know, be noting the shells and the animals and the crabs down there. But then I noticed I started having some communication with the animals. So I would pick up, you know, I would hear maybe what a spider was talking to me about. And I remember when I was a young girl, I had the vision to make a lizard hotel. So I got a sand bucket. I got a bucket of ice cream, an old bucket, filled it up with sand and spent a long time making little bark huts, you know, putting water in, making lovely ferns for these lizards. I collected the lizards, caught some food for them, put it in there. And they fucked off. They legged it. But I didn't realize then. I know it's a surprise. But what I realized then, I wanted to help people. I had this sense of service.
Yeah.
So the lizards had legged it. I was left feeling quite disillusioned with this grand scale, you know, lizard hotel. But I didn't let that stop me. I didn't let that, you know, take me off the path. So I went through school and did, you know, very well academically.
Decided not to become, you know, a zookeeper or...
No, but you'll be shocked at what I wanted to be when I left school because I was good at English and talking. And back in the day, because I'm, you know, probably a bit older than some of you, some of the listeners, I used to read Jackie Collins novels in my...
a classic Jackie by the pool. Hide it from your mum. That was me. Bit raunchy.
I remember. No, I was going to tell you something else. I won't.
You can. But it might stay on. That's all I'm saying.
Doesn't worry me. But yes, Jackie Collins novels. So I actually wanted to run a male model agency. So I went off and did my first degree in public relations and film and television. I started PR and it was in the late 90s and chicks were like rocking in with their shoulder pads and briefcases and I'm turning up in flanny shirts and my tracksuit pants. And there was a bit of discordant sort of energy there. And I saw people who looked like me and I said, hey, what are those guys doing? And they're like film students. I'm like, yeah, fuck yeah, I'm going to be a film student. So I ended up doing a double major and long story short, got pregnant, you know, I suppose having sex in the police gym does that to you when you're, you know, working out with your husband, then boyfriend at the time. So sorry, Kayla, if you listen to this, my daughter. And
her friends.
Nevertheless, yes, yes. But it was also around this time, surprisingly, I got a lot of urinary tract infections, you know, if you could figure out why that would be for a young lass in a
Wouldn't have a clue. Goodness.
So I realized then, you know, that my genitals, my vagina could cause me a little bit of pain. And I sort of had a little bit of like, oh, like, why is this happening to me? And, you know, a lot of women might resonate with the urinating of razor blades feeling that you could have. So I realized that if I didn't start to treat my body with respect, learn to take a wee after intercourse, for instance, or look after myself, then, you know, my body will tell me it's not happy. So that was one little, you know, little thing that my teenage self had. So I had my daughter and I realized then, oh, sorry, when I was, we got to backtrack a bit, sorry, in the heady life of Danielle. I got caught up in the Jackie Collins novels and stuff like that. But when I was about 16 or 17, about 16, I had what I call my spiritual awakening dream. Mm-hmm. And I had three Torres Strait Island women come to me and they said, it's time for you to wake up. And they pricked my finger, my ring finger on my left hand and drew a drop of blood. And at that drop of blood, I started vibrating in my body and I left my body. And I was running across the field and I had shape-shifted into a wolf. And then I was watching a very natural life and connected to people living, connected to the environment. And then I came back into myself. And in the background, there was a Torres Strait Islander gentleman, but these three Torres Strait Island women were standing around in front of me and asking what I was. And I said, I was a wolf. And they said, okay, you need to go with this other person. So I started from that time getting a lot of teaching from spirit about different healing modalities. So you have to remember that I was a young lass growing up in Wynnum without any real cultural support. My grandmother lived up in Cairns. And our families were further away in the Torres Strait. Yet this stuff came to me nevertheless. I would be taken up into a different realm in nighttime. I was taught crystal surgery. So I can actually use a crystal now to like pull energy from people's bodies and suture up auric tears. Now, that's not something you're going to be taught in medical school, obviously.
Definitely not. It's not on the curriculum at this point.
No, well, his fingers crossed is part of the revolution. But I started noticing I could travel into people's bodies and I could see things before I even knew medical, you know, what was happening inside of our body. And I also started pouring my menstrual blood on the garden before it was cool.
Instinctively. So
started doing that. And so all of these little signpost things led me to where I am today. And it was spirit told me that I was going to be working with women and babies. So I thought I was going to be a midwife. So I am a frustrated midwife. That's why I love the work that you do so much. So I got into nursing in the view of becoming a midwife. But I also, what I loved about nursing was that they had the modality of healing touch. And that was very similar to the energy work because I always felt I needed some way to describe what it is I need to do, what I do, why my hands get hot, how I can travel into people's bodies, how I can read it. So for me, I've always been searching for the piece of paper or to find how this fits in, some sort of modality. So that's why I got into nursing. And around that time, my poor old dear dad got very sick with diabetes. So Torres Strait Islander man was a vascular path, had a stroke, and he became very unwell. So long story short, I finished my nursing degree and spirit started telling me I was going to be a doctor even before I started nursing. And I was like, oh God, no.
Have been such a like juxtapositions coming at each other. One, you've sort of had all of these childhood experiences, these experiences that at that point would really be seen and even are by a lot of our community as completely woo out there. You've got a partner that's actually supporting you and sort of keeping shtum, not making comment on the fact that, you know, pouring menstrual blood onto the ground as a sacred ceremony.
Sacrament.
Thank you. Thanks, sacrament. Yeah. Thanks. Here we go. Katie's dictionary. Here we go.
Katie and words.
I just mix them all together. for me to have had those incredible experiences, even to go down to the nursing path, seems quite a different path to have taken. But I totally get what you mean in terms of there are parts, definitely a lot of parts of nursing. When we think about the real ethos of it, and when I've spoken to nurses in my sphere, and just that, particularly being with maybe older people, and just that hands-on touch, that being with people, the caring of when you wash someone or when you make them feel comfortable, that's so much more than we can kind of put value on.
But
to then move and have worked within that, and to have seen how doctors work, and there are, of course, some areas of medicine where there is much time to listen and be hands-on, but there's a lot of, when you see ward rounds, they're in, they're out, it's like we stand there, we look at the patient as a patient or a number, these are the diagnosis, this is the medication, this is the treatment, nurse, fulfill these needs. And it's not as hands-on-y as I would imagine someone coming like us, like you had that background. That's huge to dive into.
We'll be right back.
I just wanted to pop into your luggles and tell you about my brand spanking new podcast, The Feeding Couch. This podcast ain't just designed with pregnant women or new parents in mind, but also for all of us working in the space of birth work. This is the podcast where I hand the mic over to a different mom, dad, parent, or even grandparent to take us on their feeding journey. Every story matters. It's often through hearing others' experiences where we find our own inner knowledge, strength, and courage. Listen in to hear the stories told of triumph, challenge, heartwarming, tear-jerking, fist-pumping, and how we each deal with our venture into this new world emotionally, socially, and physically. Whether you're a student, a newbie midwife, doula, lactation exam prepper, or just hungry for more knowledge, these stories will also give you a backstage pass to the global lactation clinic. Whether you're pregnant and seeking information or supporting those on their journey, I can't wait to see you on the couch with me soon. Oh, and a little favour, your reviews on Apple Podcasts mean the world. They're like magic beans that help spread the podcast out for those who need to hear it. Let's make this something amazing together.
It was profound. And I remember when I was a nursing student, I had something which, for me, you're talking about how do these two worlds sort of combine. And I was, when you're a nursing student, there's not much you can do really. So I think I was packing cotton wool balls in the storage room, and I heard the code light woo-woo, come out, and you like run out because something exciting's happening. Yeah. And it was my patient I was looking after. I was like, yes, yes. But of course, we're useless in a crash. Like we're like useless in a met call. So I'm standing back against the wall, and they're bringing in all the big machines that say Bing and, you know, lights and so, and I'm just standing there. But it was so profound because he was playing relaxation music. So I was like, oh, like this sort of thing. But I could see two worlds at once. I thought I was like a salamander that has their two eyes above the water and two eyes below. And I could see his spirit. You never die alone. I've been with people when they die, and their spirit, like they're a mob that come and hold space for you while you transition. So he had his people with him. And I was back up against the wall, and I could see, you know, people taking bloods and blood pressure cuffs, like the physical aspect happening, but colliding with this spiritual world. Mm. And it blew my mind. It blew my mind to see it melding and coming together. Suffice to say, he survived, and everything was sort of quiet in the room. All of his spirit friends had, you know, gone back into the other realm. And I was putting the blood pressure cuff on him to take his blood pressure. And I was just looking at him, and I said, like, for me, that was such a profound moment to see the crossroads. And I see myself, and spirit has told me that I'm a keeper of the crossroads between life, death, birth, and rebirth, which really brings me to the work I do in this world around our womb, around our pelvis, around our blood, around our birth, and around our death. You know, that's it's a powerful thing to be able to edge walk those worlds and those realms.
Oh, that is beautiful. I love, thank you for sharing that. And just I love how you've described that as edge walking, that is in birth and in death. And you know, there's a lot of talk, and there's a lot of people who are bringing up this conversation of almost like having midwives for when we're passing over and for death. And we need that kind of support. And we have that with nurses who work in hospices. But I think that's really touched me, that phrase of edge walking and being there. And that really brings into that we're walking alongside with someone. We can't necessarily save them or change them. It's their journey, but we're there to support them in the best way that we can, if that makes sense.
Hmm. Absolutely. So when I got into medicine, being a nurse made me a better doctor because I understood, I watched the fragility. I watched people cry when doctors had left, not knowing what they'd been told. And I'm the one there holding them at their hand when I was a nurse.
Yeah.
So I went in there with this empathy and big heart. What I found was interesting also when I was working as a nurse is that I had to shut my psychicness down. My energy had to become small because I would go in and I'd pick up spirits and I'd know when someone was about to pass because, again, I would feel that sort of energy building. And so it became almost too much for me. So I had to shut it down. I also put on a lot of weight because it's almost like that energetic protection that I needed to shut everything down.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, long story short, I got into medicine and I'm sitting in the the auditorium of, 500 people. And I felt like a charlatan. I felt like I shouldn't be there. I'd totally asked my way in there. Mm-hmm. I felt like I had no right. What right did I have to be into medicine except spirit wanted me there? And the lecturer came in, boom, boom, boom. I didn't know anybody there. And he's like, if you believe in homeopathy, you might as well leave now. So what chance did a little Torres Strait Islander woman who can travel into people's bodies and who can see spirit, how do I fit into that world?
I'm surprised you stayed for the full lecture. You must have been going, oh, my God, one, I'm a nurse, are they going to judge me for that? Two, I've got this background. I'll just keep stum and say nothing and see how long I last.
That's right. But it was in that first year of med school, I joined the Australian Indigenous Doctors Association and I went out to Alice Springs and I'm sitting out there at this conference, all bright-eyed, eager little medical students, watching these amazing Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander doctors who have gone before me, like brilliant people who've carved the way. And I was so excited. And then on the stage, these two old men came out with a translator and they were the Nunkari. And they were the traditional healers, but they started talking about things that I could do, like traveling into people's bodies and pulling stuff out.
Wow.
And I was beside myself because I'd never met anybody like me. I never knew anybody like me. And so I went up to these old men afterwards and I was like in their presence, I just started weeping. And I'd like to say, it wasn't cute weeping. It was like, love me, hug me, like that sort of stuff. But it was profound. And those old men and I developed a beautiful relationship over many years. And they taught me a lot of stuff about magic. But they were acknowledged in that community of Indigenous doctors as being doctors, as having that traditional knowledge. Because I always go in my little brain, where's the evidence? I hated evidence-based medicine when I started uni because I said there's no evidence for me.
Yep.
What could, like I'm not making up what I can do. I know that I'm powerful and I know that I've got this magic and it's been gifted to me, through many different lineages. But where's the evidence for this? Yeah. And it was once I did a shamanic journey and I was, because I got through medicine, lots of stories there, got through medicine, came out, got through my junior doctor years, had a lot of really interesting experiences on the wards again, particularly one when I was in palliative care. I was at the ward call. So that's where you like run around the hospital all night up and down doing the little jobs in the evening. And I had to go and certify somebody's death and he'd only just died. And I had to acknowledge his spirit as I went in, because we have to do things to check that they're really dead, and, you know, put our stethoscope on them and like touch their eyes and stuff like that. And I didn't want his spirit watching me do that. It was a bit of a weird thing. So I had to really talk to him about what it was that I was about to do. And I remember walking outside and sitting in on like around in the Rose Garden. I looked up at the hospital. It was like a breathing entity. The stress from down in the emergency had like flayed its all the way up through the wards. And I know that you ladies would have felt that too, like the hospital's pumping like stuff, and the energy and the, you know, the cortisol levels are rising. And so when you're a doctor working in that area, or a health worker or a midwife or a nurse, your body gets impacted by that energy, because we don't, like, you know, shamans or the nunkery don't walk around cleansing that energy out. So we are constantly going in and working in that space. Women are birthing in that space. You know, we're opening ourselves up to our most sacred self, but we're, you know, being vulnerable in that space.
Wow. Yeah. That's probably, I mean, that's just put completely into words, even at this stage, why, you know, I just never gelled. I couldn't be in the hospital space. It was community midwifery that was my, what kept me in midwifery for so long, because I found I could never describe it. I just knew that I didn't feel comfortable. And maybe it was the practices, but it was, when I went to Australia, it was the first time in, I don't know, maybe 8 years since I had to work solely within the confines of a hospital wards. And I was a lactation consultant, so I worked from ward to ward, but based on a postnatal ward. And it was really difficult for me to not, to have to go every single day into a hospital and not sort of get out into a little GP clinic, or like in the UK, maybe a church building, or, you know, some community space where you just put some screens up and had an antenatal clinic, and in women's houses. And I knew I didn't want to do nursing, because, and I had done nursing as, you know, when you're 16 and you go on your placement, because I didn't like being in hospitals. I didn't like the smell. I didn't like the atmosphere. There was just something.
And you'll find that it's like the energetic imprint of the trauma, of the sadness. You know, the hospitals, there's a bit of joy, but I'm sure that the trauma and the sadness and the fear and the scared, like that, they embed into the walls of the hospital. Like, we can clean it down for staff aurus, or, you know, golden staff, but how do we cleanse that energy? And so when I go into women within the birthing field, I put up an energetic protection. I like hold all that energy back, and I channel the birth portal energy and hold that space, so women are birthing into that space.
Wow. That's giving me goosebumps, but it also makes me realize that I think even midwives or women or people who are not connected, they're working as midwives, who are not necessarily connected with this, I think we instinctively feel that. And it is about this kind of making this safe, sacred space for a woman who is birthing. Because, you know, even those actions of dimming the lights and putting different music on to change the atmosphere, we know that that's to do with oxytocin and to bring down these levels of stress. But it's also about changing the vibe, the energy in the room, and creating that as her sacred space that feels private and is hers. And I think that's an instinctive thing that we have that is different, and we're allowed to do that, so to speak, or we're enabled to do that as midwives, because it is about this journey.
Absolutely. There was, I won't mention the hospital, but a lot of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people weren't happy going to the hospital because they felt that the energy was bad and they felt the spirits there. So they asked the nunkery to go in and smoke it and cleanse it. And the elders were saying that, you know, they almost had like one came out with a bite mark on them from like a big energetic snake that was like held onto him. And so they had to fight a lot to like clean the space. And, you know, again, we think about where, what land other hospitals built on. Like, we don't think about things like that. So I'm very aware when I work magic that to make sure I ask permission from the spirits or ancestors, make sure I'm not working women's magic or women's business on a men's space. And you'll feel that in your body. Whereas, you know, we go in and just have this patriarchal idea that we can do whatever the fuck we want, wherever we want, you know. No one's going to tell me what to do. I'm going to build a big fucking hospital there because that's convenient for me. It might be on sacred land or sacred sites and cause a lot of trauma.
Wow, yeah. And that's, you know, most of us don't even think of this. I mean, as a European coming in, there's so much history we don't know. I mean, I'm British. Goodness knows we know a lot of what we have done. And this is so important. And it's not just in Australia and New Zealand. There's Indigenous land all over the world. And that's, yeah. Oh, you're making me really go.
So there's, you know, if we move on to the work I do around the pelvis and the pelvic bowl and talking about this sort of energetic imprint, I was talking a couple of years ago to an Aboriginal artist called Delvin Cockatoo Collins, and she had this beautiful piece of artwork. And when I saw it, my heart's like stopped. I took a bit of a beat, and I asked her, I said, what's the story behind this beautiful piece of work? And she said she was at an artist camp at the Gold Coast when she was shown real estate advertisements from the 1950s. And they were told there was nothing there. They were selling it as pristine land. So there was no acknowledgement of the long and complex history of the Yugambeh language groups, no acknowledgement of the midden circles, the eons of gathering, of family feasting together, of, you know, initiation rites, the ceremonial circles, the Bora rings, the dreaming stories, no acknowledgement of the symbiotic relationship that people had with animals and nature. There was sadly no acknowledgement to the great mother, to the, like, no honouring of that. It was just nothing there. So through some sort of slick advertising, it was sold as untouched, pristine land there for the taking. Let's divide it up, suburbanise it, put fences along it, bulldoze it, and let's cut down those trees because they're wrecking my ocean views. But then a couple of years after that, the term menstrual ecology came to me, and I really thought a lot about it as, you know, the way that ecology means studying the interactions of organisms and their environment. And I started thinking about that in our pelvic bowl space and how we interact on the physical level of our body. So we've got our bleeding, etc., and the feminine landscape of our pelvic bowl, that inner terrain that can be influenced by our epigenetics, our life journey, the journey of our ancestors, and the energy fields that we interact with. And they store our pelvic bowl, our energetic pelvic bowl, actually store and hold information and energy. Even from when we were born, it starts to do that. So then I started thinking about this painting. This painting really brought something up into me. And my first degree, I did communications. Jackie, was her name? Jackie Collins. I was going to be the male model agency owner. But we studied this thing called semiotics, which is about the study of the sign. And so if I say to all of us, what car are you thinking of? I might be thinking of a combi van. Katie looks like she'd be thinking about a Ferrari or something like that.
Thanks.
Rach, I don't know what you'd be thinking about, love. But they're all the same thing. They've got four wheels. They drive. So then it started making me think about the stories that we were told and sold around our own menstrual ecology. So when I was a kid, there was a joke that was like about cowboys, and they were sitting around the fire, you know, spitting and chewing tobacco like they do, and they were talking about hunting and killing, and then the conversation turned to women. And the punchline of the joke was, how do you trust something that bleeds that much every month and doesn't die? And everyone started laughing. And I was a little kid and I was confused. I didn't know why everyone was laughing. But then I was told it was because you're a girl, and when you're a woman, you're going to bleed. You're going to get a period.
Wow.
So as a girl, I was taught through adult laughter that I will be untrustworthy because I will bleed.
Yeah.
So I ask your audience to have a think about what were the stories you were told. that you're crazy, you're hormonal, we're powerless, we are less, we are sickly. Our blood is inconvenient, it's messy, it's a curse, it'll cause you pain, and you have no control. But here's the thing, here's the trick of it. The worst thing that you'll be told is you'll be told that there's nothing there. Our deep connection to our menstrual ecology, our innate magic, our crossroads medicine, life, death, birth, and rebirth has been suburbanized, modernized, and bulldozed. It's been churned deep into the ground, covered up, and repackaged. Unfortunately, we've been sold a slick advertising campaign that has been in design for millennia. It's just in this modern era, it's more covert and more clever, more subtle, and it's more financially biased. Bleeding's not men's business, it's women's business, and it's not a money-making venture. It's ours, it's sacred and divine, and we need to reclaim it.
Hear, hear.
We can connect to the levels of the seen and the unseen, but we need to take responsibility. We need to reconnect with our inner terrain, and we need to take homage of it. We need to push aside all the fencings and the trappings, and we need to, like, reach down and touch Mother Earth. And we need to pour our blood onto the earth, because that signals to through our DNA to our great-grandchildren that we haven't forgotten our menstrual ecology. We appreciate the importance. We're not letting them be told that there's nothing there. We're going to help them honour and reclaim their magic of their pelvic bowl. And that makes me want to cry.
Me too. You've given me goosebumps, of course. Wow. That is such a beautiful and scary analogy. Such a great picture that you've just painted there from that painting.
Yeah, it just blew my mind that there was, because I've been down to the Gold Coast and I know where there's sacred birthing trees, and on the Burleigh Headlands there's a beautiful midden site, and I was so disturbed to see someone running past and they're putting their foot up and tying up their shoelace on it. I was just like, that's like, 5,000 years old. It, made me feel quite upset. And then also, like for us, I remember reading, I think it was a book, I think by Libby Weaver, and she used a great analogy about our timeline. So if you think of a ruler, I keep doing this, I could be doing a penis. I don't know what you think.
You're doing anything. Here. No one's going to see.
I know. I'm making it
just
you,
us.
Eddie. Just you.
Just us. It's our secret sign language that's going on.
Lucky. So if you've got a ruler and, the earth has been in existence, for 150,000 years, if you think about a ruler and we divide it up, 500 years equals 1 millimeter. So if we think about, the difference between BC and AC with the old GC, that was 2 centimeters. That's 2 centimeters ago on a ruler. So that's when we lost a lot of our power, when, the church and the Christianity. So if we got a 30-centimeter ruler, women were revealed, your golden yonis were like across the world, honoured, revered. The last 2 centimeters is when things really fucked up for women. And then if you think about in Australia, we've had, colonisation, invasion was less than like about 0.5 millimetre.
And the destruction and the changes it has brought around for everybody.
But our biology still operates on the long ruler.
Yeah.
So if we go back to the hospital, Katie, and how you were saying that you felt something when you're in the hospital, like you had to flee, and that's your body. Our body, I say to my students and stuff, our bodies are a psychic antenna. We have like a big energy field that's in front of us. And if we don't let that energy, if we don't acknowledge what's being reflected back to us, our blood will tell us shit's gone awry. So I can clearly remember as a junior doctor, I had the worst period of my life. It was horrendous. And I was I couldn't walk. I had to like stop and bend over, and I thought I was going to collapse. And a nurse said, "Are you okay?" And I said, I just, and I started crying. And then the male doctor came over to me, and I was just like about to vomit. It was just the worst pain. And he said, "Oh, what's wrong?" I said, "Oh, I'm just having a really, really bad period." And he said, "I'll just give you some Nurofen. Oh, you can go home, Danielle." I said, "Thank you." And then I just had to go home and bleed. But I'm sure if we did a survey of people working in a hospital, how deranged and our bleeding becomes, erratic. I'm a big believer. I call myself a bit of a blood whisperer. Like, your blood can tell me things. It can whisper things to me. So, and that's a lot to do with our hormonal imbalance as well. So your blood, very interestingly, is a couple of years ago, the Royal College of Obs and Gynae in America said it's a vital sign, particularly for young girls. It's a vital sign, which I thought was fantastic, because it's as important as your blood pressure, your respirate, your pulse. Mm. But you're never going to get a doctor coming into an emergency going, "Now tell me, what's your blood like? Is it jelly like? Are you passing clots? They're jam?" You know, they're not going to do that. But for those in the know, and there's a lot of gynecologists, well, not a lot, I think there's more gynecologists become interested in our blood and how that comes forward for us.
Holy shit. That's just like a massive, I mean, I feel like I know some stuff, but that's just dropped the biggest penny ever. Like, the amount of observation and you know, information we take from our blood, and yet we ignore this occurrence that should be happening for most women every moon cycle, every 28 days. And there is so little information that we are asked, unless there is a problem. There's so little information given to any of us as women about this. We just don't talk about it unless there's a problem. And then we go and see a gynecologist who will talk about it, probably within the parameters of what they've been taught.
Yeah, absolutely. So I get young lasses coming in to see me with their mums, and they've got menstrual problems and they're having heavy periods. And we know that when your menstrual cycle will start, you know, quite often it's a little bit erratic and unusual, but it's very much like this suburbanized, modernized, bulldoze it into the ground, pretend it's not happening, take a pill. It's a carefree life. You can go and play tennis in white undies if you want to. We can actually make that period go away.
Yeah. Well, body farm for you.
Beautiful. But how convenient for everybody that we can make our daughter's blood disappear. You know, no need for like magic or smoke and mirrors. We can take a pill and manage it. And for some women and some children, that might be the only thing that we need to do, because it's, you know, a lot of time off school and it's very real. But there's also other little things we can do about, you know, tweaking and talking about our good old friend cortisol. So cortisol has a lot to answer for. And as I said before, when I was talking about the ruler, you know, where our body is based on this biological survive thing. So when any sort of stress happens, financial stress, chemical stress, stress, whatever, our body thinks, fuck, we got no food. And we're running from a dinosaur. So we activate the fight or flight. We run from dinosaurs and we get fat, because the cortisol goes, shit, girl, we got to lay some stuff down on you. Get that stomach and your, like, around your thigh. So that's, you know, what your body
just adds to it, doesn't it? Just really adds to that feeling of wellness.
Yes. You're like, ugh. So here's a fun fact about cortisol. So when cortisol is high, the molecule that is, so there's a molecule that makes cortisol and there's a molecule that makes progesterone, and they're the same. So your body goes, this girl's running from a dinosaur. I need to preferentially make cortisol, and then you'll have less progesterone coming in. So then your body will be out of balance in terms of less progesterone and more estrogen that will be showing in your cycle. So then your blood, your bleeding, the way you bleed, it might be scant to start. It might be very faint, or when it does start, it might come in like a, you know, you look down at your pants and there's a murder scene. you know, like there's a been an axe murder in your underpants and you've got big clots and stuff like that. So this is the sign of the stress. So the best thing that you can do for anyone who's listening, even, you know, from ovulation coming down and around, is to up the self-care. Really, really look after yourself. And if that's something that we can teach our young girls, rather than saying we're giving you a pill because it's convenient, to honor your cycle, know where you are, rest when you need to, be active when you need to, and really use your hormones that your brain produces and your body produces to your own benefit. Like, I really do try. I've got a informal menstrual policy in my workplace because I work as a medical educator as well. So I run the Indigenous health training team for a place that teaches GPs. So part of my work is, you know, working with a group of women, is that I try to be on when I'm not bleeding. Doesn't always work out that way. And then that's the time I stood up in front of 100 doctors and told them I'm basically a witch and can travel into people's bodies, but I was bleeding and I was like, like this. And I was waiting to be dragged out the front and, you know, burnt at the stake. But that vulnerability that I was showing and that like few emotional tears, everyone in the audience was crying and people came up and said, that was amazing. So again, it's using our strengths and our vulnerabilities in our cycle to our benefit.
Absolutely. It's beautiful. I mean, for me, I want to touch, or I don't know if Rachel, you want to touch just the world and the cycles or the groups that I move in outside of sort of midwifery, even within midwifery. There's so many of us that don't even know our cycle. And it seems something so simple to, and it's so helpful to know exactly what you're saying when you've kind of got these different powers or strength, because it's very different depending on what week you are in and where the moon is as well. And, you know, I've had many friends sort of say, and then after a few months of maybe talking about this, they start to track it. And these are people who perhaps are, you know, really into sport, and then they start realizing, hey, this is always when I'm really exhausted, or this is when this happens. And also, I think it's important to note that when we start to go into the menopause and our cycle is all over the place, or when we have hit menopause, there is still a way of recognizing where your cycle would have been and how your body still is connected.
And even if you're, you know, have a marina, or so you're not bleeding actively, or you're on the pill, or you've had a hysterectomy, then you're with the moon. So then you follow the moon cycles, and you acknowledge, like, at the full moon you would be ovulating, and at the dark moon is your time to go inward. On day three of our bleed is when we're very psychic and open. I can't remember the village, but they used to bring women out on their day three of their cycle from the moon tent or the blood lodge or whatever beautiful thing that women could go and, you know, rest in. And they revered the magic. The dreams that they had was something that was really important. But again, this was all, you know, more than that 2 centimeters on the ruler. Like, that's a lot of when that culture and that blood knowledge was important.
I was just actually talking to the student midwives. We did menstrual cycle last week, so we had the moons out and the phases of life and hormones and all of that stuff. And, you know, we were looking at it in terms of, you know, helping women to understand their menstrual cycle before they have babies helps them in pregnancy to understand how they, because we all respond to different hormones differently and have different needs when, you know, we've got high progesterone or estrogen, and really understanding how you respond to your menstrual cycle and your hormones and what you need at different times can really help then in the journey of pregnancy and birth, because a lot of it really kind of mirrors, you know, the hormones in the menstrual cycle. And that, you know, it's not, you know, I particularly don't like estrogen. I actually don't enjoy ovulation. I feel scattered, particularly if there's a full moon and I'm ovulating. I actually just can't think. I can't get my brain into any kind of grounded sense of thinking. So
And I think since I, in medicine, I found I really had to carve out that self-care for myself, because you know, I had the idea of, you know, I remember telling myself once as I'm running around the ward, I think I had like a pneumonia, but I still had to be there, you know, like all of that sort of stuff. And I remember thinking, I'll sleep when I'm dead. What sort of, you know, fucked up thought is that, that you'll have this fleeting thought that I will sleep when I'm dead? Like, come on. And this is the abuse that we put through our bodies. And we still say, please, bodies, you know, function for us. Help us. Help us, little gentle little. If you see the size of, you know, what our little hormones are produced out of in our brain or our ovaries, they're teeny tiny. And, you know, we've got all these like little micro neurotransmitters trying to float around our body, trying to do their job, but they're coming up against not only the physical blockages of, you know, fat or whatever it is, but also the energetic blockages that we have. And so thinking about all of these things really took me on a journey to understand so I could help women about, you know, all of our energetic spaces that we have in our pelvic bowl. So it's probably, I feel like it was around 2016 or 2017. I did, I became a holistic pelvic care practitioner and I studied with Tammy Lynn Kent, and fantastic, beautiful woman and beautiful study, but it sort of unlocked something very ancient in me, like this sort of knowing about a different way of healing. And I came away and I thought, this is, you know, because I could really feel my energy when I had my finger inside somebody and, you know, holding space in their yoni, their pelvic bowl, whatever you want to call it, holding that my finger in there, I could feel the pulsations of the different energy that was stored in there, because I'm a very, you know, energetic, sensitive healer. And so that was quite interesting to me. So then I started doing this exploration. I did a shamanic journey because I wanted to understand the energy that we hold in our body. So I went to the pelvic area, the uterus to start with. And as we know, we've got the three, or as people might know, or they mightn't know, we've got the three layers of the uterus. We've got the serosa, the single cell little lining around the outside. And then we've got the myometrium, and then we've got the endometrium on the inside. And so for me, the endometrium is very much like snake energy, the life, death, birth, and rebirth, and the gentle fluctuations. And so that holds and represents our growth, bloom, and decay. I really love these little things in our endometrium called spiral arteries. They are amazing. So every month they start to grow under the influence of estrogen, and then they like reach their little arms out and they're trying to nourish the endometrium tissue that's over the top of it, and then they start to die and they're like, oh, and decay. And then that's what helps trigger part of the shedding as they sort of withdraw their nutrients. I love them. They're just, I think they're really undervalued. Let's all high five the spiral arteries. And it is very much with the moon, the endometrium. And then the myometrium is very much Xena warrior princess. That's our, you know, the warrior energy that protects the feminine. So it could be that divine masculine energy that protects the feminine. And so even if you have a hysterectomy, it's like the energy imprint of these things are still there within us. And so we can still really hold that space. So what I found is that in my journey working with women in doing the holistic pelvic care stuff, is that we hold and record energy in our pelvic bowl. It's like a singing bowl, if you imagine, like that. So we hold and record this energy. And I see imprints of people from like their young child. I see their childhood wounding in there. So I've had women who have totally disassociated from their womb space if they've been sexually assaulted or they've experienced trauma as a child. Mm-hmm. I can be feeling trigger points inside them and they will feel nothing. They feel numb down there because they've been disconnected from it. They hide from something that hurts us, okay, that causes them pain. I saw another beautiful one. If we talk about the ovary energy, the whole energy of the uterus, like when I feel it, it's like a big gentle pulsing. It's like undulating. And to me, it's the hearth. It lights our central fire. Mm-hmm. And so then the ovaries are very fast and rapid, like the energy of them. And they have this, they're like the fire that stokes the hearth. So they bring that energy down. I can go back and heal like ancestral lineages by tapping into the energy of the ovary. So it's really beautiful. And I had this woman once, and on her whole right side, when I felt the energy, it was just like there was this big, massive deficit, like nothing was there. And when I was tapping into the right ovary energy, it was just, it was vacant. And I thought, that's really strange. And then I had this stroke of brilliance to bring the energy from the feminine, from the left side, and bring it across to the right and let it slowly fill up. And then it sort of activated and came into life. When I spoke to her about it afterwards, she said her mother, her mother's mother, and mother's mother, all had men that left them. So they had this ancestral wounding that was being evident in our womb space. Mm-hmm. So I, and even, you know, women who have, I work a lot with women with IVF who are on the IVF journey. Mm-hmm. And you think again, like the hospitals, it's the pain and trauma and loss that, and feeling scared and feeling worried. We all hold that in our womb space. When you go to the procedure room, we hold that in our womb space. The pregnancy loss that they might have experienced, they hold that in the womb space. And so I'll feel women release the energy, and sometimes it'll feel like cold come over me, and then they'll start crying. I got a lot of women who have an emotional response and want to have a release, and they'll start crying. And I'll just let that energy come back down and sweep down to the Great Mother. We do a connection ceremony beforehand and afterwards. But it's really interesting to get people to connect to their uterus or into their pelvic bowl space to see what it looks like. What do they perceive it as? And they're using their psychic, you know, intuition. And some people said it's like a dead garden. And at the end of the session, it might be blooming again. The walls might be crumbly and dark. But then, it, you know, there's a light that comes in.
Yeah,
and see, this is, you know, this is the privilege and the honor of the work that I get to do, to be able to work in that space and to be able to, you know, help women improve their menstrual cycle, help them connect to it, but also like let babies land into that space, you know, once we've cleared it away. It's profound. I'm pretty lucky.
I think I wanted to ask, how would someone, you know, for women who are out there who maybe don't even, haven't even contemplated any of this, they're at that point where, you know, they haven't even investigated the story of how they found out about they were going to start to bleed. They haven't looked deeper into that and how perhaps that has reflected in their journey as becoming a grown woman. And they're not connected with the cycle, but perhaps they are going through things that are within the cervix, within the uterus, needing to see a gynecologist. How can women connect with this? What would be some of the first steps to enlighten women to start thinking about this on a different framework, perhaps?
I think when we need, you know, if women need to seek medical help for a particular pathology in their, you know, womb space or cervix, I think it's really important to start noticing what you're feeling around you and in your body and what's happening for you in your home life and what's been happening for you over the last couple of years. Because we know, you know, if you think about it in energetic terms, your energy will be disrupted and then it'll come into the physical aspect of it. So I've, you know, I've worked a lot with the energy centers that we have and the nerve plexuses that lay over those energy centers. And so we've also got things like the fascia that lays over the top of that. And that's what we work a lot with in the womb space when I do the womb work. So the fascia like connects to everywhere in the body. So where is your sense of distress coming from? Where do you feel powerless or maybe not in control, if that's the story that you're feeling? So there's a lot of being a detective and not rushing into everything. Like don't start going, oh, I need to take, you know, this and that and this, you know, this and this is good for me. Take a moment to pause, because in our busy life we don't do that. The best thing you can do to help your menstrual cycle is to bloody pause, particularly in that last 14 days, up your self-care. If we can get cortisol down, cortisol is one of the greatest disruptors. Look at things in your life. Get some bloody sleep. Like our circadian rhythm is so stuffed up, like so wrecked that women, you know, that's one of the best things we can do. And sleep in the dark. When I pull my eye mask over my head, I get like a little goosey bump. Like it's like it's my little like a little girl, like going to sleep and feeling all safe and secure, like that sort of thing. I just love it so much. And the blackout blinds, because any light that comes in will actually disrupt our circadian rhythm. And we really need to get that back on track, stopping the artificial lights. Eat, like, it's all those things. Nourish your body, eat well. You can't expect your body to do well if you're in a stressful workplace, for instance, and then you're trying to batter it with and to relate to your cortisol level. The drive from that, you know, the biological drive is to eat food and eat shit food. I need sugar in that afternoon. Mm-hmm. You know, we all do it. They're the big thing. So the first thing I say is pause and be a detective. What's going on in your life? Like, I had a fella who he literally sent his wife in to see me. And she said, you know, I'm like, how can I help you, polite doctor? She goes, oh, I think I need to go on the pill. I said, oh, yeah, you know, what makes you think that, or what's brought you to that conclusion? And she said, oh, my husband said I get really angry and PMS-y. And I go, yeah, but maybe you're just pissed off.
Like, I love it how her husband sent her in.
Yeah, yeah. But see, this is the thing. Like, this is the controlling sort of stuff. So really taking that moment to pause and reflect. And then how do we connect you to yourself? And I think even just trying to do a visualization, like try to put your hands, touch your hands over your womb. Like, I get women when they come in and they do a shamanic journey work with me, I get them to literally walk around and touch the wall of their uterus, making that physical connection. Like, we can all go up and hug a tree and touch a tree and make connection with the bark, but we don't do that to our womb space. We don't even visualize what that feels like. And I often get them to say thank you, show gratitude for what you're holding for me, the pain, the trauma, whatever it is, the stuff that happened to me when I was a kid. If we think about the cervix is the gateway to mother. It is the point of what is most sacred. It's the veil between the worlds. We can shift through the veils and go to Avalon if we want to. You know, like, this is the majesty of our cervix. And when we are disgruntled, or when our feminine magic is not being honored in society, in our homes, within ourselves, if our menstrual ecology isn't known to us, then your body's going to respond. Your hormones are going to respond. And your poor little cells, we've got this really cool mechanism in our cell called apoptosis. So basically your cell will go through and click, 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 check, check, check. You get like all these little, like, I think about like little nerds with little folders, and they're like, cell, okay, tick. You know, like when you go around and check the toilets at a shopping center, 2:15, well, it was clean. Like, it's the same thing within the cell. But when our bodies are so stressed and distracted, that apoptosis can't work properly. When we've got inflammation in our body, our immune system can't work properly. So this is how disease develops, out in the energy field and then coming inward to us.
And this, for me, is a real point of when we're getting those early signs. Perhaps, you know, someone who is having a lot more pain during their bleeding, and they've perhaps been to the doctor, or they've been to the referred to the gynecologist, and they've had an ultrasound, and everything's come back as normal. And it's almost that you're dismissed, and then you think, well, there's nothing wrong with me, I've just got to get on with it. Instead of saying, maybe this is a sign that I should start taking that time, that pause, listening to my body, thinking about what I'm doing, what I'm changing. And maybe it's an early warning sign to say, I need to change something in my life.
Absolutely. This is the beauty of our blood, is that every month we get a chance to reflect. We can stand, you know, in week 3 or week 4, and we can look back and go, how was that last month for me? Did I look after myself? Did that, you know, so-and-so at work piss me off? What can I do to improve it? It's standing in that marga power, like in the week 3, as we go stand in the autumn of our life. It's that reflection and say, I am the empress of my world. I'm the empress of my universe and my uterus. How do I look after my domain? So every month we have a chance to do it. We fuck it up, we've got another chance to do it again. Life, death, birth, rebirth. Life, death, birth, rebirth.
Every month.
Every day. Every day we change. This is why they're like, why, you know, they're scared of women and our power, because we're fucking shamans and we change every day. We're not stagnant. We're not boring. We don't stay, you know, the same. We're like, fucking guess which one I am today,
bitch.
Hell
yes.
Yeah, yeah. Which, you know, and that's why they come and they try to say, oh, can you like go on some tablets because you're like cranky. She's probably like just Carly, destructive, you know, blood moon fucking goddess, like, like
I'm feeling things and energetic and seeing things. And this is the time when she's like, I'm going to get this down. I'm having these dreams. I'm having this vision. Yes. I need to write them down and see what they mean for me. And yet and we want to just paste it all over and make it, you know, Stepford Wives. And we all need to be the good girl and fit in our lovely, beautiful house with our picket fences and make everything look nice. And we don't. We're not like that all the time.
We're wild. We're wild. And we try to suppress our wildness, which is sad. Like when I was a young girl, I'm like, I love the full moon. And if I bleed on the full moon, I'm such a witch. And look at this. Now I'm like, bitch, bring on that dark moon energy. And I'm like just hanging in the car, rolling with my women. And we're like, you know, cruising around and causing havoc and, you know, knocking over letterboxes and stuff like that. Like we're ready to rumble. This is us in our dark moon energy. Like, yeah.
And I think when we recognize it, if someone's never noticed this before, when you start noticing it, it gives you the ability, like I actually will change my kind of diary in what I'm doing or who I'm going to see because of how I know how I'm going to feel. And
absolutely,
it's super helpful. It's like, oh my God, I'm ovulating then. And I'm actually the other way around. I ovulate on a dark moon, which I think is, for me, it's changed when I moved and there's a reason for that, I'm sure. And it's, you know, it's just knowing these tiny things, but also paying attention and not being fobbed off that if your period or your bleeding has changed and, you know, there is an inner knowing that something's changed, that something's wrong, taking the time to be your own sort of intuitive, listen to your body and gut instinct and make some changes. And then, of course, if those progress, involving your doctor, asking for a second opinion, going to see someone, because there are times, of course, when we need that.
But also recognizing I think I was learning to be a GP registrar, I think. And so I was sort of doing that, like where you sit in the back of the, you know, the proper doctor's, you know, and you're like the little person sitting on the side of the seat. And this woman came in and she's like, oh, she's not feeling well. And, you know, she was sort of talking about some vague symptoms. But this is where, you know, I really appreciate my intuition and my witchness and my wildness that I can bring into the medical practice, because I was sitting there and I started receiving information from her. And the doctor was just like, oh, here's some blood tests and this is this and blah, 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 and you can go. And I just sort of went, oh, shall we just like check her stomach, like have a little palpate? And he's like, oh, yeah, knock yourself out. And then I palpated and I felt a massive mass in her body. And I was just like, doctor, would you like to come and like, you know, have a feel? And she had this really rare aggressive cancer. But it was her intuition that brought her in. And I said, you know, as doctors and nurses and midwives and, you know, edge walkers and keepers of magic who remember the old ways, we need to actually, this is part of my health revolution, is that we need to acknowledge and bring our magic into these spaces. There needs to be the interface. You know, we've got a particular skill set. You can't ask like Wolverine to keep his like, you know, metal things inside him, because that's part of who he is. And that was my big journey with medicine, is that I tried to hide who I was as I was going through medicine. And that, you know, I had to sit these big exams. I ended up failing by 0.6% because I kept trying to play the game. So I called my magic back into me and I acknowledged the elders and the nunkery and everything I had within me, the witch within me, I acknowledged and brought home. And then I was able to pass the exams. Because if I didn't have that devastation of failing and then having to do it again, I would have just been trying to fit into a world where I didn't belong. So, you know, and I think there is space for, I've just finished doing a 9-month Medicus course. It's, you know, online with doctors and nurses in Australia, but it can be around the world. But it's for people who want to learn about their magic and step into it. And using that extra sensory knowledge that we have to be able to help you hold space for people, assess people, but listen with things other than your ears to people. And I've had that time and time again in my GP practice when I'm trying to be Strady 180, but then I hear that voice. So I think it's a privilege for people like us, the witches in the cauldron, to be able to stand space and hold space, but it's not easy. It's certainly not easy. You know, obviously there's going to be judgment from peers, but hopefully most of them are there. There's people who are called to this because we're healers. We've been healers, you know, lifetimes, priestesses, whatever it is that you want to be, and we've been called into the most difficult place, this intersection at this time, you know, the age of Aquarius. Systems are being challenged and we're at the forefront of it. So that's why I love your podcast. I was frothing like, oh, midwives, tick, cauldron, tick, tick. You know, like it's amazing. It's an amazing energy imprint to be bringing into the world.
Thank you. Thank you. Oh, that's lovely. So, Danielle, that was fantastic. I feel like we've been on a journey. Do you have any words of wisdom or final thoughts you want to leave us with?
I do, actually. And I think I'll sort of draw back on where I was talking about the menstrual ecology and that beautiful painting that really set me on a bit of a contemplation, a deep thinking sort of adventure. And there's a thing that happens. There's a group of people or men or people that I met there called the Murray Rangers. And so basically what they're doing is relearning fire stick burning. So the way that we deal with bushfires in Australia is like burn the shit out of everything and fingers crossed. So the Murray Rangers are looking at the ancient ways of fire management and land management that Aboriginal people used to use on this country. Mm-hmm. So they would walk beside a fire that was a cold fire. So it wasn't like warfare. So they would listen and they'd watch when particular plants are flowering and they'd know it's time to do it. And so that the land would invite them and tell them the stories and help them remember, because a lot of that stuff was lost, of course, due to stolen generation and, you know, a lot of trauma and stories being lost, elders dying early. So that made me think a lot about how we can relearn our magic just by sitting down with the earth, with our great mother, and traveling inwards to our inner terrain and understanding that we might have been disconnected from our sacred practices, but we know what to do and we can learn how to take care of ourselves. And as warrioresses, we need to connect with and know our inner terrain, our wilderness, and our tenderness. We need to know the health of our ecology and listen and watch for the signs to tend it and then take active steps to heal it. And we need to see beyond this advertising, this slick advertising and the modernization of our pussy and our pelvic bowl. And we need to honor the seasons within and without. And we need to acknowledge when we need to connect to the earth and to honor and nurture the earth's crust as we nurture ourselves, because that's what's going to allow our survival as a species. And so we also need to honor the stories that we've been told and sold about ourselves and our menstrual ecology and our inner terrain. And we need to let go of what stories are causing us harm. And we need to acknowledge that there is something there. Okay? It's our magic, our life, death, birth, rebirth. And it's pretty fucking amazing. And we can't let anyone tell us otherwise.
Wow.
Thank you so much.
That's a bloody perfect ending. Thank you so much, Danielle.
So I really hope you enjoyed this episode of The Midwife's Cauldron, and it is just a joy, as always, to receive your messages. Please take the moment to go to iTunes and rate us and review us, because this is how we get the message out. This makes us more visible to our community and all of us in the cauldron, and more of us that should definitely be here. So we thank you and we appreciate you, and we also ask you to just take that 5 minutes to go and pop over to iTunes. So of course we normally end with some bloopers. There definitely were bloopers with this episode, that's for sure. I mean, we cannot seem to record something without having bloopers. But Dr. Danielle has actually left us with something really quite special. So sit back, make sure you're in a comfy position. Don't do this whilst driving, and join her on this journey. Enjoy.
What we might try today is a shamanic journey just for you to connect and visualize your pelvic bowl. Hold your womb tenderly. So, of course, if people are driving, please don't do it now. Let's be safe. But just take an opportunity as your self-care. Like, take, you know, maybe pause this and come back and listen to it again just before you bleed. Tune in. Understand. Or maybe at the start of your cycle, when those lovely little spiral arteries are starting to make their way out of your endometrium and starting to balloon. Choose your cycle, whatever you want to do. And so, everybody, what we're going to do today is we're just going to do a visualization, and we're just going to get you to place your hands over your where your womb is, and if you don't have a womb, where that space is, because it's part, you know, it's how we connect to the divine through this space and through our the gods and the goddesses and our ancestors. So we're just really acknowledging that space. So just hold and connect and really feel into your body. And what I'm going to do is just do some drumming. And with that drumming, just really start slowing your breath down. Take this as an opportunity for your self-care, for you to look after yourself and honor yourself and your cycles within and without. So just focusing on your hands. And if you like to, you could even imagine a light, a gentle light coming out through your hands into your womb, into your pelvic bowl space. And just notice what you feel and maybe what you see. Thank you. and with your hands over your stomach, just pay attention to what you're noticing, what you're feeling, what you're experiencing. Honoring your connection within and without. Honoring your ancestors and the traditional owners of the land on which you're standing. Honoring your great mother and how you can mother yourself, nourish yourself, nurture yourself. So start bringing your energy back in. See that beautiful light that you had in your hands start to dim. And you can bring your hands from your womb space up to your heart and just hold that energy there, acknowledging you and your life journey. Make a commitment to understanding and honoring your menstrual ecology, becoming familiar with your inner terrain. And deepening your desire to connect to the magic within. And just take a big deep breath in and out. And you can come back into the room, back into this time and place. And just honor that space in between. Feeling the stillness land in your heart, in your womb, in your cells. The pause. And thank you.
Thank you so much.
Wow. Thank you.
Wondering which of my courses is for you? Breastfeeding and Lactation, the Fundamentals has been designed for everyone working in the birthing field or those on their journey to becoming breastfeeding specialists or IBCLCs. This course gives you 7 hours of CPD and is packed with reflective learning, case studies and some pretty tough at times quizzes to make sure this stuff sticks. It also means you can meet me monthly in my live Q&A. This is my course that I hope will fill in the gaps that traditional breastfeeding education has left out. I want you completing this, feeling confident to support any breastfeeding or lactation challenge of those in your care. But wait, I have another course called The Feeding Couch. Who's this for? Currently, around 80 to 96% of women decide to breastfeed during their pregnancy, but by just 8 weeks after birth, a third to almost 50% of those women have stopped breastfeeding. And of those women who stopped, 80% say they stopped breastfeeding before they wanted to. Learning about breastfeeding during pregnancy has been shown to improve breastfeeding self-confidence and improve the rate of exclusive breastfeeding in the short and the long term. I believe every mum should be able to choose how she wants to feed her baby and for how long. Knowledge is power. That's why I created The Feeding Couch, designed to be watched during pregnancy or for new mums and parents who may be struggling right now with breastfeeding. The content is in step-by-step, binge-worthy whilst pregnant or for those most tired of days postpartum, totally easy to find exactly what you need and dip in and out when you need a breastfeeding answer quickly. And for you, beautiful podcast listener, there is a 10% discount off both courses when you use the code POD10, that's P-O-D-10, at checkout. To find out more, hop on over to my website, katiejames.site, and have a look at the incredible content waiting for your lucky peepers.